I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Fred Litwin joins me now. He's just written a book called Conservative Confidential Inside the Fabulous Blue Tent. I just finished the book, and it's an engaging read about Mr. Litwin's own personal political coming out as a conservative. He grew up in Montreal, steeped in socialist thought, reading Chomsky and the sort. After September 11, 2001, however, he began seeing the world differently. He moved to the right, and he chronicles the evolution of his political thinking. He looks candidly at politics in Canada, and it'll be interesting to get his thoughts on the current election campaign. He also looks critically in the book at how the CBC and the media operates, as well as the gay establishment. He's got a lot to say about the selective attention that mainstream gay leadership in Canada, especially with regards to the treatment of homosexuals in the Middle East and elsewhere. You might have known Mr. Litwin from his work founding the Freethinking Film Society, which screens films and documentaries in Ottawa. In 2011, a screening of an anti-communist film was cancelled at the Library and Archives Canada when it caved to pressure from the Iranian embassy. He tells that story in this book. Fred Litwin is a marketing and sales professional who worked for Intel. He founded Northern Blues Music, a blues record label. The website for more is at conservativeconfidential.com. The book is published by Northern Blues Books. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Ottawa today, Fred Litwin. Mr. Litwin, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Well, pretty good.
So as I told you before we started, I rather enjoyed the book, and I'm curious to know why you decided to write a book.
Well, I really decided to write this book as almost an answer to some of my friends on the left that I lost in the years after 9/11. When I found myself increasingly being ostracized at parties and dinners because I was the lone voice on a variety of political issues. And I just found there was a certain intolerance to many people on the left. And I wanted to write this book to let them know what I was feeling and what I was going through at the time.
So for a lot of people, it may seem like a stretch that someone who grew up in the 60s, as you did, a political protester in Montreal, to being a conservative in these last 15, 20 years or so. But 9/11, that really changed things for you, and I'm wondering how.
9/11 was a huge wake-up call. I found myself on the morning of 9/11 watching this on television, totally transfixed, and asking myself, you know, how could people do this? What kind of monsters are these people? You know, a horrendous crime has just been committed right in front of my eyes. And I thought it was a time for me to sit back and really think about what was going on. And over the weeks and months following 9/11, what I found from the left, or should I say the postmodern left, was a series of excuses over what had happened. And basically it all whittled down to America had it coming. America sort of deserved it. And I just found that was just absolutely obscene. And it started me on a major round of soul-searching that ultimately ended up a few years later of me working for the Conservative Party.
And so how is it that your political thinking has evolved, but, say, the left hasn't?
Well, when I was protesting Ronald Reagan back in the early 1980s, I was always really kind of upset that here was a man who was very, very quick to fight for freedom in the Soviet bloc, but would ally himself with death squads in Latin America, and who would seemingly ally himself with a whole variety of horrible authoritarian dictators. I thought that was just unconscionable. You know, I thought that the main challenge, the main thing that we were fighting for on the right, on the left back then, was to get rid of these dictators, to allow people to live in freedom. Here I was, you go forward back into 2003, and you actually have a right-wing American president who is toppling a horrible dictator in Iraq, and the left is very upset. And so I found in many ways I really hadn't changed, but the left had somehow gone completely ballistic.
And why do you think it is today that members of the left are still mired in their way of thinking while you haven't?
I think that the left has just unfortunately become way too enamored with identity politics, which I cover in the book, and feminism and the worst parts of gay politics. And they've forgotten, and also anti-colonialism and anti-imperialism, and they've just seemingly forgotten that you sometimes have to fight for freedom. You know, I'm really struck today how you've got Bashar al-Assad throwing, dropping barrel bombs of nails on civilian populations, and the anti-war movement is silent. They're not asking to stop the war in Syria. They don't say a word. And so I find this is really a betrayal of internationalism.
What I found quite interesting in the book was that you said coming out as a conservative was more difficult than coming out as gay.
It's very true. When I came out as a gay man in the early 1980s, you know, it was a very nerve-wracking thing to do, but I found that I had a great group of friends, and they were all very, very supportive, as was my family. But when I came out as a conservative in, you know, 2000, in the mid-2000s, I found there was a complete wall of oh my God, how can you do this? What are you saying? It's impossible. People said that I had a false consciousness. They couldn't understand how somebody who was gay could also be conservative. And I found that just absolutely flabbergasting, because I had fought for years for the right to be myself. And now all of a sudden people were saying, well, you can't think that way because your sexual orientation is this. It was completely baffling.
And, you know, I recall 15 years ago when the Liberals were still in power in Ottawa, and people were wondering who Stephen Harper was, I guess a little less than 15 years ago, you know, because he'd come from the Reform Party, and they were somewhat hostile towards homosexuals. There was all this talk in those elections that Harper ran about this agenda, this fundamentalist Christian agenda, that if you were a homosexual, things wouldn't be good under a Stephen Harper-led government. So you joined the Conservatives about 10 years ago, or so. What's been your experience within that party?
Well, I joined the Conservatives because I met a candidate in the 2006 election, Keith Fountain in Ottawa Centre, who was quite liberal on social issues and supported same-sex marriage. And I just found that we were sort of soulmates, and I decided to work on his campaign. I was, to be honest, a little nervous. I didn't know what would happen to me within the Conservative Party. Locally, it was a really, really great experience. I had met a lot of friends, and I was well-received. I was immediately put on the board of the electoral district of Ottawa Centre. But at the same time, I realized that there was a lot of work to do within the Conservative Party to make them friendly or receptive to the gay community. And I've always done that my whole life. When I worked at Intel Corporation, I started a gay group for employees in Europe. And that was new, and it wasn't hard. I had to fight for that. But I did it, and I worked from within, and I wanted to do the same within the Conservative Party.
Well, what was your experience in terms of how the policy evolved over gay marriage? I mean, did it really evolve, or was it something that they just didn't really, it wasn't a priority for them, say, and that's why we have it in this country today and continue to have it?
Well, even during the same-sex marriage debates in Parliament, Stephen Harper was arguing while he was a member of the opposition that he was against same-sex marriage, but he certainly wanted to have all the benefits for gay couples in some sort of civil union.
Mm-hmm.
But they were clearly against same-sex marriage. But once it passed, I think Stephen Harper realized, first off, you know, there's really no going back. But also, he was never really motivated that much by these sort of social issues. He was always interested in the oil sands, he was interested in the economy, he was interested in free trade deals, and topics like same-sex marriage, I think, really just bored him, and he really didn't have an interest.
And so on when he invokes the phrase old stock Canadians, as he did in a recent debate, is that playing to his base, or does he think like that?
I think, unfortunately, and this is one of my biggest criticisms of the Conservatives these days, is they spend way too much time playing to their base. And I think you saw it in the whole Syrian crisis, where all of a sudden he was fear-mongering in terms of, oh my God, thousands of refugees are going to come and they're not going to be screened. And that was never the case at all. We were always going to have screening. So I think every now and then he plays to his base, whether it's with tougher penalties for different crimes, and I think that's the worst part of the party is when they pander to the base.
And is the base today that old guy who called reporters lying pieces of shit?
I kind of like that guy, but he had a little bit of spunk in him. I actually have a little bit of admiration for the guy, and I understand where he was coming from. But there is a soft underbelly of I don't know what you call it, of anti-Muslim sentiment, anti-immigrant sentiment in that conservative base. And you saw that in the debate over the refugees, where all of a sudden there were people saying, oh, you know, why are there so many men amongst the refugees? And why, you know, and it's an invasion of Europe. And there was that fear-mongering and inability to really think straight about how we can help these people in need.
And so do you think that the Syrian refugee crisis will be an election, will be something that people will be thinking about as we go to vote in the next few weeks?
Well, I think all of the parties are really on the same page in terms of accepting refugees. I think that, you know, I think Stephen Harper will continually drive home the point that we're the only party really thinking about security. We're the ones that's utmost on our minds, and I think that there is Canadians are concerned about security. So I think there's a part of this that's a wedge issue for the Conservatives, and they'll certainly use it.
In terms of this current election campaign, because we're 3-4 weeks away, what do you make of what's happened? I don't really like asking for predictions, but do you have a sense of what might happen on after October 19th?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I've been really struck, and I've been saying this for a while about the Conservatives, that they seem to be running out of gas in the sense of, you know, there's no big policy, no big things, ideas coming out of the Conservatives. They're just the same old tired stuff, don't change, stick with us, you know, we're better. And I'm struck by the fact that the Mulcair has moved the NDP right to the center. It almost appears like he would be a great leader, that he would have been a great leader of the Liberal Party. I think there's a lot of issues that never really get discussed in these election campaigns, and I don't know what's going to happen. I think there'll probably be a minority government of some type, and I would say probably it might be Stephen Harper with a minority government. Then we'll see what really happens afterwards.
You write at the end of the book that you may just let your membership to the Conservative Party lapse.
Yeah, I find that Stephen Harper is actually quite timid. It's not that he's the evil ideologue. It's not that he's this evil Christian. It's the fact, really, that the truth is that he's moved the party to the center, and he's really quite timid, you know, on issues like, for instance, the CBC. You know, he'll tinker with their budget a little bit, but he won't take any bold move to change the way the CBC is structured or how it works. The military, he's actually not done that much for the military, and our procurement is a complete mess. And there's many other conservative files that, in fact, he won't even touch. He's actually, I think, timid, and I call him in the book arrogantly timid.
Some might say pragmatic, but you think that, for example, on the CBC, because you spend some time in the book talking about your problems with it going forward, how should the CBC, what should the CBC's place be in this country? Were it up to you?
Well, if it was up to me, I would really change the way the CBC is funded and structured. So I think that the CBC should really be answerable to its viewers and listeners. And I would move it to a model more like that of PBS in the United States. So that, you know, the government would contribute maybe 40% of its funding, and 60% would come from donations from its viewers and listeners. And I would divide it up by province to make sure that a sizable amount of donations would have to come from each province. And that would mean that CBC would be answerable to viewers and listeners in each province. And I think that would give us a diversity of opinion, or far more than we have now, and I think that you'd get much better local coverage as well.
Well, when you say that Stephen Harper is timidly pragmatic, I tend to think that he's pragmatic. I would say he's pragmatic because he wants to remain in office. And do you think he's been corrupted by power, say?
No, I, I, I don't think he's been corrupted by power, although I think he's been very disappointing about the way he runs the Prime Minister's office. But I think that there, in this country, there's not a whole lot of conservative think tanks in this country that provide a wide range of policy ideas and options for a government. And that I don't think the Conservative Party invests that much money in policy options. And so when you go back to 2006, when they won that election in 2006, Harper won and he had five main priorities. Remember, it was lowering the GST, it was the Accountability Act, wait times in health care. There were a few others. And he quickly did most of those. He sort of punted on health care. And I always expected, okay, now he'll come up with five more priorities. And he never did.
Yeah.
And he never really came back with more priorities or more big ideas that he wanted to do. And I just think that, you know, there's no big ideas, no big vision coming out of the Conservatives.
So what do you do then on election day? Do you sit on your hands? Do you endorse this government by voting for them again?
I don't know. I would not sit on my hands because I think it's an important duty of everybody to go and vote. So I'm going to go and vote. I'm really not sure who I'm going to vote for. I won't vote for the Liberals or the NDP. I'll just have to consider. Maybe I'll spoil my ballot. I don't know. Libertarian, maybe Conservative. I'll see, but I'm not sure just yet.
So what is the state of the Conservative movement in Canada? Now, I ask this as someone who is a Conservative, and you know, you moved to that side of the aisle, if you will, politically in these last 15 years or so. Whatever happens after October 19th, does conservatism continue? How does it evolve after all of this?
Well, I think it's going to evolve when there's a new leader. So I think at some point Harper is going to retire, earlier if they lose the election or later if they win. And somebody else will come in and hopefully, I hope that somebody like Jason Kenney will come in and bring some ideas and some philosophy and ideology back into the Conservative movement and give a purpose for what the Conservative Party is all about.
How have you found the political discourse, not only in this country but around the world, since 9/11? Have you found it to a little more difficult, say, discussing ideas? Has the rhetoric been coarser?
It's very coarse, and it's very, very hard to discuss ideas anymore. And you know, we've become so polarized in what we watch and what we see on the web, and you could see it in Facebook. You know, the horrible arguments that people get into. People don't want to discuss things. People are off in their own little corners, reading the websites they go to. There's no shared experience. Like, you know, even people really aren't reading newspapers that much. Television is now, you know, you're off in Netflix and watching what you want. And so people are off in their own little worlds, and they really don't want anybody to disturb them. And we've forgotten what it is to have a rigorous debate on a lot of things.
One of the interesting things in the book that you talk about that I don't think a lot of us remember, I mean, I'm in my early 30s, is the idea of how the left views Israel. Because people of your vintage, people older than you, will remember the left really coalesce around Israel in those years, in, say, the 40s and the 50s at Israel's founding. And now the left doesn't like Israel. So the left has changed, hasn't it, rather than Israel? Or has Israel changed?
Well, the left has really changed on Israel. I mean, the left used to be huge Zionist supporters. Israel was a socialist country. It was a member of the Socialist International in very good standing. I think where things really started to change was back in the mid-60s, when the Soviet Union launched huge anti-Zionist campaigns around the world. So there's a lot of anti-Zionist propaganda moving around the world, and it helped mold the Palestine Liberation Organization under Yasser Arafat as not a terrorist organization, but as sort of freedom fighters in the vein of other third world insurgencies. And all of a sudden they became the darlings, no matter what about their tactics. And that whole campaign worked, and it went through through the counterculture, and before you know it, Israel is now the number two enemy in the world.
And so did you see that changing at all? I mean, I doubt it will.
I don't know. I don't see it changing. I'm always hoping that, take the trade union movement, which has become very anti-Israel. I really keep on hoping that, there'll be trade unionists who will see the light and say, you know what, this is, we are wrong on this. We have to change this. The sight of another Hezbollah flag flying with Cup W at a rally is just obnoxious. We have to change things. I don't want to hold my breath. I'm hoping that things over time will change, but I don't see it just yet.
You also write in the book about your frustration with the so-called gay establishment. You single out the newspaper Extra in this country. We've already touched on say, the views that the mainstream gay establishment has with regards to freedom. That's frustrated you a great deal.
You know, it's just an incredible story when you think that gay people right now are being hanged regularly in Iran. They're being thrown off buildings in ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. And where's the gay community? You know, they're worrying about whether we can wear assless chaps in gay pride parades, or articles on how much should sex workers charge, or whether queers against Israeli apartheid should march in gay pride. I mean, it's just astounding that you have a large part of the world without any rights, or a large part of the world where there's no gay rights, and our gay community is obsessed with homophobia, perceived homophobia in Canada. It's really, really embarrassing when you think about what the gay establishment is doing.
The book takes on all sides, if you will. I mean, there'll be people on the right who won't like what you have to say. At the end of the day, I mean, we started the conversation by why you wrote the book. Who do you think should read the book?
Well, I'm hoping everybody will read the book and find something they like and dislike. But because I have a message, I think, that's really appropriate to Canadians today, and that we could play a bigger role in the world. The Americans are retreating, and so it is our chance to shine, to take up some of that vacuum left by the Americans, and we could be the ones that could fight for freedom and liberty. A good example is Syria. Right now, we could be the ones within NATO leading a revolt to get NATO to have a no-fly zone in Syria. We could take a bigger role. And I think that's the message I have for everybody, and I hope people sort of realize that this is a message that's appropriate, not just for conservatives, but for tough-minded liberals as well.
Now, I understand that Terry Glavin, your friend Terry Glavin, helped edit the book. Is that right?
Yes, that's the right, yes.
Yeah, he's a legend in these parts because of his environmental reporting back in the, in the 70s and the 80s. And he's had such a great renaissance in the last year or two. I guess he appears regularly now in the Ottawa Citizen and in the National Post, and then on this story on the Israel file. I mean, he's done outstanding work, hasn't he?
Terry's amazing. I mean, I'm really proud to have Terry as a friend, and he really played a huge role in the shaping and editing of this book. I worked very closely with Terry in this book, and he knows this material cold. He really understands all of this, and he had a lot of value add in helping me tell this story and shaping it and advice on how it should be structured, and it was a real fun time working with Terry. I think he's like the best journalist in Canada, and I'm really proud to be his friend.
He's a good guy, too, isn't he?
He is a great guy, and I mean, he really cares about a lot of things. He is a very, very proud Canadian. He does a lot of great work on a lot of files, from Aboriginal rights to Israel to Syria, you name it. And Terry is just and he's a man of the left. He is a decent man of the left, and we need more Terry Glavins.
Yeah, I'm always astonished when I read something that he writes, and I'm surprised with the take that he has on it, because you see quite clearly just what a sparkling mind he has.
He sees things that other people can't see. Every column of his, he does a tremendous amount of research. I can tell you, he really agonizes over every column, speaks to a lot of people, tries to find out things that nobody else knows, puts it all together in a way that makes you just, whether you're on the right or the left, you've got to take notice of what he writes.
So after all these years, being a conservative now, I guess there's no going back, is there, for you?
Well, there's no going back. I mean, I'm a man who I'll go wherever I can find a place where people are fighting for liberty and freedom. You know, if you remember the old days when there would be people like Henry Jackson, who was a Democrat in the States, who really fought for freedom, for liberty, for Soviet Jews. He was a Democrat, but he really fought. Those were the days when we had sort of what I call tough-minded Democrats, muscular liberals. I long for the day when a political, take the fight against ISIS. The conservatives really didn't do that much in the fight against ISIS. I wish that one of the political parties, the other opposition parties, would have said, I'm embarrassed, we should be doing more. And I long for the day when we might have a liberal party that would stand up and be muscular and want to fight for freedom.
Fred, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. Congratulations on this book and good luck with it.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. The website for more, conservativeconfidential.com, that's where you can get the book. It's a terribly engaging book, and you'll learn a lot. The book is called Conservative Confidential Inside the Fabulous Blue Tent. It's from Northern Blues Books. It's author Fred Litwin. Join me on the line from Ottawa in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.